The download is complete.
Welcome to the AV Forums podcast, presented by Phil Hinton.
Hello and welcome to the Home Cinema Podcast for May. Coming up, we take a look at Cinema 3D from LG. We also discuss reviews of LED projection from Digital Projection. We preview Teufel's Concept 500 speakers. And we also look at the VT30 and ST30 plasma TVs from Panasonic. Plus, what is home cinema? And joining me for the Home Cinema Podcast this month, we have Steve Withers and Russell Williams. Good evening, guys.
Good evening, Phil.
Good evening, Phil.
And apologies that it's not a full house. Unfortunately, Mark's not feeling very well, so hopefully he'll be feeling right as rain before the end of the week, so wish him well. Right, so lots to talk about this month, and we're going to kick off straight away with our trip over to Paris. That's myself and Steve. We're invited out there by LG. Quite an interesting trip. It's the first time I'd been on the Eurostar. Through the Channel Tunnel, which was quite an experience. Although I think we were talking so much that we missed the whole experience.
You didn't even notice it, did we? So one minute we were in the middle of London, the next minute we were in the middle of Paris.
It was a small party that went out there. It was more of a European launch event, but really quite impressive once we got out there. I mean, it's my first time in Paris, and I just thought the city was absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, we were lucky with the weather. It was absolutely gorgeous the 2 days we were there, And so you couldn't imagine a more perfect environment to see Paris in for the first time. You know, it is the kind of city, a bit like New York, that delivers exactly what you expect. It doesn't disappoint at all. Certainly the trip on the Seine, which was beautiful, and LG. I mean, obviously, as you say, it was a Europe-wide launch event for their Cinema 3D passive 3D TV display range, and they pulled out the stops, didn't they, Phil? In terms of The event in the evening in particular, they had a huge display of their 3D cinema 3D line of TVs, as well as a projector, and obviously they had the world's largest ever 3D screening, which was very impressive. I think there were half of the glitterati of Paris were there that night, although you and I wouldn't recognise any of them. But
we were standing on the red carpet, and it was like, who's that? Don't know. Who's that? Don't know.
Yeah, it was all these cameras and flashes going off, and we're like, "Who the hell's that?"
well, to be fair, I mean, if you plonked a Frenchman in London's West End and you had all the, you know, TV personalities and that turning up from the UK, people wouldn't have a clue who they were either. So
I don't think I would either, to be honest, Phil.
Yeah, I think there was a couple of footballers there. There was definitely a film director there at one point. Forget his name. A couple of actresses. Sophie
Marceau
from Braveheart fame was the main
and the world
guest. Let's talk about the actual products instead of the celebrities that were there. Obviously, Steve was there. Flashes and everything going off when Steve walked up there. The TV, Steve, the first time that we've had a good chance to have a look at them, but still not in any kind of detail or pass any real judgment on them. But I thought it was interesting that definitely the marketing side of things this year, quite clever, and at the same time, certainly not telling the full story.
By calling it Cinema 3D, they're trying to, you know, associate their TV, passive TV line, with people's experiences of going to the cinema, which of course predominantly, not always, but predominantly involves using passive glasses. But what they're not saying in any of their advertising and marketing is the fact that in order to do passive on a TV, it's half the resolution. It's basically 540p for each eye. Whereas at the cinema, you're getting 1080p for each eye. And they're claiming in the marketing that it's been classified as full HD. I think was that right? Yeah, that was the term they used. I think full HD.
Yeah,
in 3D. By some organization I hadn't actually heard of, and I have to say that's just not true. To me, full HD 3D is 1080p for your left eye and 1080p for your right eye. And in reality, with a Cinema 3D passive display, you are seeing 540p with left eye and 540p with right eye. Now, whether you're aware of that loss of resolution when you're actually watching material is another issue entirely. And in fact, if you're watching, say, Sky 3D broadcasts, well, they're broadcast at 540p for each eye. So you're going to be seeing exactly what they're broadcast anyway. But that's another issue. But in terms of their marketing, yeah, they really are avoiding that subject. Obviously, with a 3D Blu-ray, you have full 1080p for each eye. But when you're watching that on a passive display, you're still only getting a resolution of 540p for each eye. Although, you know, given it's coming off of a 1080p Blu-ray, it does look quite nice. And I think the additional depth that you get with a 3D image kind of tricks the eye slightly into thinking there's more detail there than there actually is, because you're also getting depth information as well as line resolution. Now, some of the things that they mention in their marketing are quite valid. I think my experience of a passive 3D TV, and certainly from seeing them at the press launch, you know, they're very bright, they're flicker free, the angle of viewing is very wide, which is good. Obviously, the glasses are very light, very cheap. I think they're including 7 pairs initially with the TVs. You know, but you can, if it's a real D cinema you go to, you could even use the glasses you take home from the cinema with an LG passive cinema 3D display. So there's lots of valid points that they make in their marketing, but they do basically dodge the one issue that I think they're going to get caught up on by a lot of people.
I think we also have to point out it's not just LG who like to massage figures for their advantage when it comes to marketing. So we're not just picking on them. LG in particular.
I think what I'm saying is I don't blame them for doing that. I mean, clearly they're trying to promote the advantages of passive, and there are plenty of advantages to passive, in my opinion, and sort of not dwell on the one real issue that people might pick it up on, which is resolution. But you know, that doesn't make a difference. If when you're watching a 3D Blu-ray or Sky or playing a game, and it looks great, and there's no, you know, it handles motion very well, and there's no crosstalk, and there's no flicker, and it's a nice bright image, and the glasses are light, and you don't get a headache, then there's lots of reasons why you might want to go that method.
Yeah, it's a perfectly valid argument there, Stephen, and you know, for the most part, I totally agree with what you're saying. There are other issues that you add in there that I think it's only right that we talk about, which is, first of all, it's an LCD panel. Now, we haven't had the Cinema 3D TVs in for review yet. Hopefully, you're going to get hold of one this week. So we should have a review up in a few weeks' time with an actual panel. But I guess the point I'm trying to make here, Steve, is A, we're dealing with LCD panels. We all know what the technical deficiencies are with the LCD, although it, you know, some manufacturers are managing to get their LCD panels looking extremely good these days. Then you're adding in a filter to the front of the LCD panel, obviously to do the polarization for the passive 3D. That's got to have some effect on image quality when you're looking at the TV for 2D only. Do you not think?
True. I mean, that's a valid point, Phil. I did review the LD950 the end of last year, and had to say that that was a passive 3D TV from LG. And I didn't find that it particularly impacted on the 2D quality. I mean, I thought it wasn't a great TV, because basically it was a fairly an LD 920, which is the one they were using in pubs with Sky, and that was basically what the LD 950 was. So I think, you know, it wasn't the greatest LCD TV to start with, and I'd be more interested to see what they do in terms of the quality of the build, the quality of the LCD panel, and how the actual filter on the front affects the image quality in 2D. But certainly, you know, I have to say that when my experiences with the LD950 were that I was quite impressed with it for 3D, to be honest. I had a friend who's very into 3D, and he'd seen all the active displays that I'd reviewed up to that point and hadn't been that bothered, but he was suddenly enthused when he saw the LD950, just because he found the using the passive glasses just so much more pleasurable in terms of, you know, they were lighter, there was no syncing, there was no batteries, no flicker. He found that when we played video games on it, it handled motion better, and it was a more immersive experience in terms of the gaming. So I will be interested to see what the 550 looks like when it arrives this week, and hopefully we should have a review by next week.
So I guess the question here is, Russell, after listening to that, when it comes to the video side of things, I think you've actually admitted yourself that you know, it's not something you pay a great deal of attention to in terms of geekdom. So I think we can treat you as a layman here.
Fair play.
Passive, active, pluses and minuses, has it had any impact on you?
The first thing that struck me that Steve said straight away was somebody said seven pairs in the box. So you've spent your £1,000 plus on whatever on your TV and your whole family can watch it without laying out any more money. I think that's going to appeal to a lot of people. And I can especially see with, you know, probably people who are even more layman than me walk into a showroom where there's some 19-year-old spotty know-nothing at the front trying to sell you a telly. And that's going to, you know, people are going to see full HD, 3D, seven pairs of glasses that don't need batteries, sold.
I think that's a fair point, Russell. I think exactly. I mean, one of the big problems is, you know, although they have, you know, certainly picture quality wise, no question, you know, a good active plasma looks fantastic in 3D. You know, a lot of these TVs are being shipped without any glasses at all. Certainly the GT30 and the ST30 don't. So, you know, you buy your TV, then you've got to buy, say, an average family of four, another four pairs of glasses. It's sort of 70 quid a pop. And then you've got to trust your children, who are quite young, not to break them. And if you have some friends around, you don't have enough glasses. That is one of the big problems with the active shutter system, I think. And it's certainly something that LG are making a big point of, which is, you know, if you want all your friends to come around and there's going to be 10 of you to watch a big sporting event, for example, in 3D, you know, the glasses are almost free, really. You know, they hardly cost anything. And that you're right. I think to the casual purchaser, that could well be a selling point.
Again, from my casual observations of these things, when I saw the sort of like that half resolution sky standard you were talking about earlier on, I saw that on a big screen on an extremely expensive SIM2 projector a year or so back. And frankly, I thought it looked staggeringly bad, but I could see that being not such a problem that the jaggies were very, very noticeable. I could see that not being such a problem on a 42-inch telly on the other 12 foot away on the other side of a room. I think most people probably wouldn't even spot there was a difference.
No, you're right. Absolutely right, Russell. And I think that's the point. I think when it comes to big screen projection, clearly you need active shutter. You need the additional resolution. When it comes to a 42-inch TV, even a 50-inch TV, in someone's lounge, is it such an issue? Not really, no. I don't think so. Not certainly not in my experience.
Okay, I'm going to play devil's advocate here just for a second. Active manufacturers see this. They see the fact that the glasses are cheap, so they cut their prices and take that away, so the price of glasses is no longer an issue.
Well, if passive gets a foothold, they're going to have to reduce the cost of the glasses, aren't they? Because otherwise, they're going to be nowhere.
I don't think it's just the cost of the glasses, though, Phil. There are other issues with active shutter glasses. I mean, they are quite heavy. They do require batteries or recharging. They do require syncing. I think small children are going to have problems with them. People do suffer sometimes from headaches watching through active shutter, because ultimately it is flashing really fast. You know, you do get eye strain. So there are other issues associated with the active shutter system that rather than just the cost issue, although I think the cost issue is certainly right now, at least, definitely an issue, although it may become less of an issue, as you say, as inevitably the price of active shutter glasses begin to drop over the course of this year.
But then the other argument, sorry, I'm just playing devil's advocate here, just to get a little bit of debate going, but The other point is that, you know, mass market, Joe Bloggs, always goes for the bigger number. We've already established the fact that passive is a half-resolution system, so a good salesman is going to get them to buy the full HD 3D TV.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Phil. In fact, I mentioned that to LG when we saw them in Paris. I said, you know, you can do all the dancing you like with your marketing. Ultimately, you're at the mercy of the point of sale. If the salesman is going to pushes the big number, and exactly the same way that whereas at most sensible viewing distances, people wouldn't be able to tell the difference between a 720p TV and a 1080p TV. The fact is, no one's going to buy a 720p TV because everyone goes for the bigger number. That numbers definitely do influence people's purchasing decisions. And I think LG will be better off addressing that up front rather than trying to sort of fudge the issue.
It does slightly smack of another format war, though, doesn't it?
Well, you know, some of the mainstream press try to wangle it that way, but it's not really, because both technologies, they both give you a 3D experience. They just do it slightly differently, and one's half resolution, one's full resolution. So it's not really a format war. Although LG have certainly gone against the tide. Certainly at CES, they surprised everybody with this whole cinema 3D thing, because I think the whole industry had kind of assumed that everybody was going to go down the active shutter method route. And with them doing that at CES, it has changed the tide somewhat. And the likes of Sony are now looking at adding in a passive TV. And there's one other manufacturer.
Toshiba as well? Did Toshiba do it?
Toshiba are doing one on their budget 3D TV. And Philips as well. So it's gone from LG announcing that at CES to now other manufacturers now looking at that as well. So it's gone from active only to now being two options. But personally, I don't see it as a format war. Do you, Steve?
No, it's not. It's definitely not a format war because both systems work quite happily with Blu-ray games and TV broadcasts. So it's not a format war at all. That's just the press stoking it up. Although, to be fairly honest, LG and Samsung in particular seem to be quite aggressive in their comments towards each other. I guess because they're both Korean companies and they're the biggest two manufacturers in the TV manufacturers in the world. And certainly they've been quite bullish and slightly aggressive in some of their comments in the press, which I think has stoked the whole format war story. Although in actual reality, it's not at all. Not at all. It's just a different way of delivering something, but they both work with the same media. So ultimately, it's just a question of which you think is preferable for your needs, really. If you want the resolution, active shutter. If you want cheap and cheerful and something that you can use with your kids, I'd probably recommend passive is more likely the way to go. But I guess like anything, time will tell and we'll see what the consumer decides to do.
Yeah, Russell, is the consumer even interested in 3D?
Not especially, but I have to say the idea of the passive system does have its attractions in the way that the active system didn't, because of the disadvantages. I've still yet to really see a active system that I actually felt comfortable with over, even short viewing. It always felt slightly, I don't know, it felt like I was trying to pull focus with my eyes all the time slightly. It's certainly not as comfortable as the passive experiences I've had, which admittedly have only been in the cinema in front of much bigger screens, and you're watching a picture reflected off a screen rather than one beamed at you with the light from the TV itself. So I'd certainly be interested in taking a look at it. I actually personally think for my sort of use, where I don't have a projector in my front room, I actually think it probably sounds like the system I'd go for if I was going to jump.
What would be interesting is once again, at point of sale, because first of all, you've got the possibility that the salesman pushes the bigger number, which is, certainly is quite common when it comes to any kind of AV product. It's always the big number, always seems to sell it. But also, what's interesting is when Phil and I were in Berlin, we just for laugh wandered around a large electronics retailer, and were looking at their 3D display, the 3D TV displays. I think almost all of them were set up incorrectly, so the image was terrible.
That's a given, isn't it?
Well, I mean, the thing is, it's probably less likely to screw up setting up a passive one than you are with because obviously the glasses turn off or they're turned off or the battery runs out. People are going to look through it and think, oh, that doesn't look very good.
So you're saying,
With passive, as long as the glasses aren't broken, they're going to work. So that might be an issue that would play into passive's hands. Although, having said that, at the LG press launch, one of their TVs was set up wrong and I had to point it out to the guy. And even then he was going like, looks okay to me. I said, what are you talking about? It's inverted. Just turn the 3D off and back on again with the remote control. It'll be fine. But, that kind of thing is always going to be a problem, I think, when they're displaying 3Ds at point of sale and the people who are doing the selling haven't got a clue what they're doing.
Yeah, I mean, you got to remember, this is for every manufacturer, that when you go to these things and they've got another manufacturer's display there, don't expect that other display to be set up correctly.
No.
It's not going to do them any good if it looks better than their products. So I always take those things with a big pinch of salt. And I've got to say they had Panasonic. Oh, I'm not allowed to say what model it was, but I've got to say it's the worst looking Panasonic plasma 3D that I've seen. So
the funniest bit on that trip was when we were staying in this quite nice hotel in the middle of Paris, and in the rooms they had Samsung TVs, and someone had put a piece of black tape over the name Samsung. I guess they thought it might offend the LG people that were staying in the hotel.
Yeah, I mean, you get those things from time to time, and it is quite funny to see the old corporate stuff happening.
It probably wasn't LG who did that. It probably was the hotel thinking we don't want to cause offense to LG.
But anyway, it was a worthwhile trip. The other thing, I think we touched on it briefly, but was the showing of Rio. Yeah. on that massive 27 by 11 meter screen. That was quite an experience. using four Christie projectors, you know, one for each segment of the screen. It was beautifully blended together, and it was actually quite a stunning image in such a huge auditorium.
Yeah, no, it was very, very impressive. And actually, I would say quite an enjoyable film too, Rio. Quite charming and sweet, made by the guys that made the Ice Age movies. It was an enjoyable hour and a half. Some nice songs and quite funny in places. And obviously, what was interesting, I suppose, the point that LG were trying to make was that people were using their passive glasses to watch the film with. And we had some quite nice ones that LG gave us that were actually sort of designer glasses that were very comfortable to wear, actually quite stylish and looked basically like sunglasses. And I actually forgot I was wearing them during the movie. They were so light. So I suppose that's an interesting experience, us being part of this world record setting audience for, I think there were two world record sets. One was for the audience and one was for the size of the screen.
Yep.
And I suppose LG also made their point that their glasses are the same ones you might use in a cinema.
In some cinemas,
yes. I mean, I should always make that point clear. It is not every cinema, but certainly cinemas that use Real D, those glasses will work with an LG. Royalty passive.
Yeah,
we'll work with an LG passive display.
Yeah, we found that out at Bristol when we were showing the LD 920, and unfortunately we only had a handful of glasses, Real D glasses, and we went to the cinema next door and took some glasses from there, and they didn't work because it was the Dolby system. So
yeah. I've got about four pairs of Real D glasses knocking around the house from when I've been to the movies, and I used them. I did when I had the 950 for Christmas, and they worked with it just fine.
Yeah. So not all cinemas are the same, but the general idea is the same. It's a passive system, and it has its pluses, it has its negatives, like everything else, guys. And I guess the main risk is that the public just don't give a jot. Basically.
If you wanted to go, though, interestingly, if you wanted to go for a 1080p passive projection system at home, you can do it relatively cheaply. You don't have to go for the expensive SIM2 or digital projection options. You could do it by using two Optomas and the Optoma 3D XL, which I'm in the middle of reviewing at the moment. There is actually an option with that to do two projectors for a 1080p left and right eye. You could then buy some, or just pick up some glasses from the cinema, use the lenses, one for each projector, and a pair to wear, and could actually do it for a very small budget, create full 1080p passive projection at home, which is quite an interesting little, I didn't even realize until I had the review sample at home and looked at the back of it, that you could actually do that with the Optoma, but I think that's quite clever of them.
It's only going to appeal to the hardcore enthusiast.
Yeah, just stuff. to the tinkerer, the enthusiast. But still, it's the product itself.
1080p projectors are what, a grand each now?
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, if you're an Optoma owner, you know, if you've already got an Optoma projector, then £250 for 3D, even if it's only 720p if you're just using it with one projector, that's a bargain. Well, I mean, that's a no-brainer, really. Why not for that kind of money? Comes with a pair of glasses. The other glasses cost, I think, £49 for another pair, and you've got yourself some 3D to watch with your existing projector. An interesting approach from Optoma compared to maybe some of the other people who are doing, obviously, bespoke 3D projectors.
And I know we keep coming back to this point, and before we take our short break, I just wanted to cover it again, and that's content in terms of 3D. I'm looking at a couple of websites here where you can buy Blu-ray discs. There's still not a lot of stuff coming through. I mean, Steve, you're obsessed with this at the minute and obviously looking everywhere for discs.
Yeah,
there's still a genuine lack of content.
I've got every single 3D narrative movie, not counting things like IMAX documentaries or something like that, but actual movies. And I'm talking genuine 3D, not 3D conversion either. So not Alice in Wonderland or Piranha or Clash of the Titans, but actual 3D movies shot with 3D cameras or proper 3D animation. I've got every single one you can buy or not buy if they're in case of stuff that I've had to get off eBay because it was exclusive to a particular manufacturer. And I think I've got 22 at last count. So that's it, 22 movies out there. And as I point out, some of those, like for example, Avatar, you can't actually buy. So to the sort of casual consumer, probably there's about 15 Blu-rays they can buy to watch in 3D at the moment. So yeah, not much in the way of content, to be honest.
if you were to go out and buy a 3D display, Russell, is that going to be a big problem for you?
Well, that's precisely why I wouldn't. If the content's not there, what's the point?
Okay. Well, I think that was...
That says it all, doesn't it?
It's the age-old argument, isn't there? There's no points for early adopters.
Yeah, yeah.
You could end up being left with having paid all that money for something extra that ends up sort of a bit of
a
turkey at the end of the day. And there you are, whoopee, you've got your 15 movies to show other people what it could have been like.
Two HD DVD players and...
Obviously not a problem I've got at the moment, Steve, but, you know.
Yeah, but I mean, looking at other formats, HD, it had a bit of a slow start as well. I'd say probably a slower start than... certainly what 3D has had. So, but I guess the will comes down to Hollywood, and we've discussed this before, Steve, in our last podcast. It's there's not a lot of genuine 3D stuff in production at the moment.
Yeah, that's the big problem, Phil. It's not just that there aren't 3D Blu-rays out there. The problem is there aren't 3D movies to make 3D Blu-rays of. If you look at what's coming out this year, over the summer period, say, for example, at the cinema in 3D, the only films I know of that are actually genuinely shot in 3D are Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides, Stranger Tides, Transformers 3, and the Three Musketeers movie. They're definitely shot with 3D cameras. All the other stuff, Green Lantern, Thor, Captain America, this stuff is 2D 3D conversion, which is not real 3D. I don't care how much money you spend or how long you take doing it. You can't fool the eye into thinking it's real 3D, because you see it all day, every day. When you've got your eyes open, you see the world in 3D. So your eye knows when it's being tricked.
Yep, totally. And I think we've covered this subject to death in the last sort of two podcasts. But we thought it was interesting to bring up the whole LG thing, especially as we have a review coming up in the next couple of weeks. And, of course, the launch in Paris. And according to LG's way of looking at things, my 1080p display is actually a 2190. Okay, so we're going to take a quick break and we'll be back in a second.
The highest definition.
I got you the big screen TV.
And THX quality sound that would make George Lucas cream in his pants.
This is the AV Forums podcast.
So, welcome back, and before we kick off with some reviews, just a reminder that we are hosting our very own THX video calibration course in June. It's June the 14th, 15th and 16th. If you want any further details on the course, you want to book your place, you have to be quick, because it has been extremely popular and the places are going very quickly. Then the address is thx.avforums.com. All the details up there. And looking forward to it, Steve. It's getting closer now.
Yeah, no, I think it'd be quite looking forward to it. I think, it's a very good course, very interesting. And the guys that run it are really enthusiastic and very knowledgeable. But also be a nice opportunity to meet some of the members, actually, and get to know them. I'm looking forward to it.
So that's the THX course. If you're interested, like I say, thx.avforums.com. Get yourself signed up for the course. Places are going quickly. Now, let's move things on. We'll stay away from 3D just for the time being, because we've done the whole first half on the subject. So let's look at high-class projection or high-end projection for your home theatre. Steve, you've got a big cinema room there. You want something you can switch off, switch on, not worry about bulb life. What are you going to look at?
Yeah, basically, you got LED projectors. Interestingly, I think the first couple, there was the Vivitec that you reviewed and the digital projection that I've just reviewed. I mean, they were released, this time early last year. And since then, we've had the Miko 50 and 60 from Sim. But there haven't been that many LED projectors on the market, at least not ones that I'm aware of.
Yeah.
Which is surprising, because in terms of, A, it's a new technology, which is always, appeals to people, I think. And B, it does have some really big advantages, which you've just alluded to, which are that, it uses LED lights rather than a bulb. So first of all, the lifetime of the LED lights is, anything between 30,000 and 60,000 hours, or basically, almost infinite in terms of the amount of use you're going to get out of them. You could use it for 10 years and still not need to change anything. And obviously, because of LED lights, you can turn it on and off immediately without a need for cooling, warming up and cooling down. Yeah, the actual light output is quite stable over the life of the LEDs. And I think it's only about a 5% dimming, as opposed to bulbs, which dim by 50% within the first 1,000 hours. So lots of really interesting advantages to LED. And obviously, it's a new technology, which means there is a price premium still attached to it. But I think as that price gradually drops, and hopefully some more manufacturers start to release LED projectors, yeah, it's a very interesting technology, and I think one that has, really does get rid of an awful lot of, a lot of people find the big problem with projectors is bulb life, bulb brightness, dimming of the bulb, taking care of the bulb, and then the cost of replacing the bulb. So when you eliminate all those factors, it makes projection, I think, a much more interesting proposition for lots of people. And recently I had a chance to review the digital projection M-Vision Cine LED. And last year I had the chance to review the SIM Miko 50, SIM 2 Miko 50. So I had sort of a point of comparison. The digital projection I thought was an absolutely fantastic projector. First of all, it's grayscale out of the box was absolutely reference, which was incredible. I'd never seen that before. It was just unbelievably good. There was a 2-point calibration control, which you didn't need because it was already perfect, but I just tweaked around, fiddled around with it because I could. The out-of-the-box color wasn't quite as good, but it had a full CMS for primary and secondary colors. So once again, after calibration, the color performance was absolutely perfect. As with DLPs, it handles motion really well. I always kind of compare DLP, that's plasma, and, DILA or SXRD, it's more like LCD, and you do get more of that sort of smearing when you get motion on the LCOS projectors, whereas with DLP, it's a beautiful film-like quality to motion particularly, and the detail, because it's single chip, the sharpness of the image was staggering. So you had beautifully sharp images, great motion capability, quite bright, surprisingly, because it's only rated at 600 lumens. But I've noticed the same phenomenon with the SIM 2, actually, with the SIM 2 Miko, that also looked brighter than it really, than it was actually rated at. So that's an interesting phenomenon, and I'm not quite sure why that is, but it seems to be that LED projectors seem to appear brighter. But it certainly was bright enough for my size screen. It's nothing like the kind of brightness of some of the digital projection bulb-based projectors are capable of. They can do sort of 3,000 or 6,000 lumens, massive light engines. But certainly for an average screen size, it was more than bright enough. And so you had a nice bright image, really, really accurate color and grayscale, beautiful motion handling, and incredible pin sharpness. The only thing that let it down slightly was its black levels, which were a bit of a disappointment. And that was the only reason it didn't get a reference score from me. Otherwise, it got highly recommended. But I would have given it reference if it had slightly better blacks. The blacks on the SIM 2 were definitely better. And certainly, it was nowhere near as good as my JVC X3, even in terms of black level performance. So that was a bit of a disappointment. I noticed that in your Vivitech review, I think you mentioned something similar, and I noticed that their menu systems were almost identical. So I think there may have been some sharing some technology there. Maybe that's the reason.
It wouldn't surprise me if they're built on a similar chassis. Definitely agree with you on the black levels. The Vivitech was, it was the same. It was lacking dynamic range. Certainly shadow detail and so on wasn't there where you would expect it to be.
Yeah, that was a real shame, because if it had that, then it would have been an absolute knockout projector. It's still an excellent projector, don't get me wrong. It's still a fantastic projector, but that would have knocked it out of the park. But even then, even with the perhaps not great blacks, I still loathe to give it back. I was really enjoying watching stuff on that projector. I thought it was a lovely, lovely image. And like I said, I'd forgotten, I think, because I'm usually using a JVC, I'd forgotten how great DLP is with motion particularly. Mm. It was a lovely film-like image, really pleasing. So overall, clearly this is a projector. It's a £16,000 projector. It's aimed at the custom installation market. It's not a sort of a casual purchase by any stretch of imagination. But if you've got the money, I'd certainly would consider it. I think it's. I'd be interested to see what comes along this year, hopefully, in terms of new LED projectors. Perhaps hopefully a little bit cheaper, because both the SIM and the digital projection were in the £16,000 range, and I think the Vivitech was about £10,000, £11,000. So these aren't cheap projectors. These are very expensive projectors, relative to say a £3,500 or £5,000 Sony or JVC. But certainly, it's good to see that at least, you know, when you do pay the money, you do get the performance. That's one of the things that did occur to me was that, you know, okay, it is expensive, but damn, it's a good looking picture.
Yeah.
Apart from the blacks.
Yeah, I mean, these are the types of products that, you know, it's custom installation. These are the type of products that are in, you know, your CD award winning home theatres and so on, and really, really popular with the custom install market because of the performance that you get. So I guess it comes back to the old analogy, you get what you pay for, basically, Steve.
Yeah, it's absolutely. And obviously, the fact it's designed for the custom installation market is somewhat apparent by the fact that it's not the most attractive looking projector. It's a fairly plain chassis. To change the lens shift, you needed to use an Allen key. So clearly, you know, it's designed to be sort of set up, put in position, and then not fiddled with at all.
Yeah.
You had to focus it. You had to do it by turning the around the actual lens itself, which made it a two-man job because you need somebody standing by the screen to check each pixel looked in focus. But yeah, in terms of performance, no question, not absolutely superb.
Steve, I guess another advantage of the LED light engine is the fact that, unlike a bulb which changes its characteristics in terms of colour and so on as it ages, LED, that's not so prevalent. So when you come to things like calibration and setting the projector up, switching it on and off instantly, you're not worrying about the next 1,000 hours and having to get your ISF or THX calibrator back in to set up the image again. It should hold pretty stable over a certain number of hours, more than that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's definitely one of the big sort of selling points of an LED projector, is that the fact that it is a very stable image over a long period of time. So once you've, you know, had it initially calibrated, you probably won't need to do much to it again after that. Whereas with a bulb projector, as you know, you maybe get it calibrated after you've run it in for 100 hours. We need to get it recalibrated again after another couple of 100 hours, and then after 1,000 hours, your bulb brightness is down 50%. You have to look thinking about buying a new bulb and getting that recalibrated. So that's certainly quite an appealing factor with an LED projector. And in some ways, the not having to have it recalibrated and the not having to replace the bulb does offset some of the additional cost associated with buying an LED projector. I mean, when bulbs themselves can be quite expensive, you know, if it's £200-300, or maybe even £500-600 for a xenon bulb, you know, that can make the LED projector cost effective over the life of its use.
Yeah, and if you're an installer as well, I mean, thinking it from a business point of view, and I know this doesn't really affect our forum members as such, but if you're thinking it as a business proposition and you're installing one of these machines into a client's home, you don't want to keep getting called back in for warranty repairs and that kind of thing. And that's where a machine of that level, it's built to last, it's built to work, and, you know, it's not going to go wrong. And it's not going to have the same kind of build quality as a consumer product would.
No, that's true. And I think the other problem, well, not so much a problem, but certainly the issue with LED projectors, and one reason I think perhaps why they're still quite expensive and difficult to do, is that they're very susceptible to temperature change. So you need to make sure the cooling's good. Now, on the Sim 2, they actually use liquid cooling within their Miko. Although that didn't make it any quieter, it was sort of a relatively noisy projector. On the digital projection LED projector, there were 4 fans in the chassis that I could count, so it was quite noisy. Obviously, if you were doing custom installation, it was in a hush box or some sort of projector lift, you may not be able to hear it, and that's irrelevant. But certainly, if you had it sort of sitting behind you in quiet passages of films, you might be able to hear the fans. But I think that those are the kind of things. It's still basically a new technology, and it's still in its infancy, and it will just get better and better. But certainly, it has a lot of interesting selling points to it, which you've already mentioned, Phil. Things like life of the bulb, stability of the image, you know, the brightness and the color. I'd be keen to see how it develops over the course of the next year or so.
Yeah. So that's the digital projection M-Vision.
M-Vision Cine LED.
If you want to read a review, it's on the website now, avforums.com/reviews. Let's go to Russell. Russell, you haven't reviewed anything this month, but you have got lots of toys turning up. I believe you have the Toyful Concept THX speakers that have turned up recently. You've had a chance to have a little play about with them. So when can we expect a review, and what have you found out so far?
Yes, my apologies to the forum at large for having a bit tardy on the review side this month. My own sort of personal projects in the house have put paid to some of that. Obviously, you've got the Teufels, as you mentioned. I've also got the SV Acoustics SB13 subwoofer inbound. That should be an interesting one to play with. Had the Teufels for a couple of days now. I've hooked them up, run them up a little bit, sat listening to some music the other night. Slightly mixed views on them as we speak, but I think I'm going to get a head round setting a speaker on a desktop and listening to music from that range, because it's all a bit different to what I'm normally used to. They've got some good strengths, mid-range clarity and vocal articulation is very good, but I find them a little bit strident on the ear, and certainly the subwoofer is unless you're very careful with the settings of it, completely overblown.
So Russell, this is it's a little bit of a different product to what you've done so far. It's more of a sort of PC music editing, video editing type near field monitor kind of setup or gaming setup.
I think most
of our listeners would use it in a gaming system, I would imagine. So looking at it from that point of view, how is it in terms of the performance that you've seen so far? Does it fit that market?
I think so, although I'm probably therefore not their target, as I don't game. As I say, I'm still trying to get my head around the subject slightly, seeing having a quick look at what else is out there. I mean, I don't know why, but I kind of expected when it turned up, it would hook up via a USB input, but it doesn't. It only wants to accept the stereo analog output from your sound card or your headphone output or what have you, which I suppose does at least mean you can pretty much rock up with any music playing device, plug it on the end of the headphone socket and off you go. I think that's possibly the way, as you mentioned, if that's the target audience, then it does seem to have been balanced slightly with that slight lift in the 1-4 kHz region to bring out the sort of tinkly detail of bullet casings and things like that, which is possibly what makes it slightly harder on the ear when you're listening to vocals or something like that at a high level. But again, I'll experiment. I'm trying to sort of downloading myself some movie clips and whatnot onto the computer and, you know, trying to get as broad, you know, maybe I'll download some gaming trailers or something like that, just trying to get that sort of sound effect through it and see how it stacks up at the end of the day. But nothing too conclusive at the moment, other than the fact, I must say, it does look really nice, and it is very nicely built. I've heard some PC speakers were coming up, I thought, oh, this is going to be great. When a 15-kilo box turned up, I suddenly realised I was dealing with, you know, sort of a different proposition to sort of like, you know, a lot of the little plastic sort of sound sticks or whatever it is people hook their computers up to.
Review, Russell, this month?
Within the next couple of weeks, hopefully. As I say, it's not too difficult a package to get your head around. I'm actually going to also try bringing it into my front room where I've got a little bit more space. The output from the subwoofer will maybe be a little bit more in proportion with the speakers, and try it as some people will use it, and just plug it straight into my TV and just, you know, just try using it as a set of speakers like that.
Cool.
So yeah, not too hard to do, and we're working on it. And as I say, hopefully in the meantime, SVS subwoofer will appear as well, and we can get that one hopefully done within the month as well.
Okay, so if you're interested in those reviews, get yourself over to avforums.com/reviews, and as soon as Russell gets them into the coming soon section, you can click on there, subscribe, and get an email as soon as the reviews are published. And I guess before we finish talking about actual products, I think we've got to mention the VT30, Steve, from Panasonic, the 50-inch. I don't know, maybe everybody on the forums has read it now. It seems to have had an awful lot of views. It seems to have been a very, very popular and anticipated TV launch. And I guess everything I've got to say is basically in the review there. I think it's one of the longest reviews I've written for a while.
About 8,500 words, Phil.
It took me a little while, and I wasn't feeling that great at the time writing it as well. Trying to write and think, and while you're not feeling great, it's not the easiest thing in the world. But the review is up there, avforums.com/reviews. Go and have a look at it. It's also on the front page if you want a direct link through there. And Steve, you also covered the ST30, which is their entry-level 3D TV this year.
Yeah.
I guess what we found is that over the range, there's some subtle differences. Certainly the high-end VT has the better filter on the front and better black levels. But the ST30, it's not to be ignored.
No, not at all. In fact, I mean, over the last 2 months, we've had a chance to review, between myself and you, the ST30, the entry-level one, as you say. the GT30, which we talked about briefly last month podcast, which is at the mid-range, which is THX certified for 2D and 3D, and obviously the VT30. You know, and the ST30, it doesn't have THX certification, but it's got a pretty accurate out-of-the-box setting. It's lacking in calibration controls, but its overall performance was excellent. It was a very good plasma. It had 2D and 3D. Yeah, the black levels were on a par, in my opinion, with the GT30. I think they use the same filter, actually. So ultimately, you know, if you're looking for a reasonably priced 2D and 3D plasma, or perhaps your first experience of 3D, then it was, you know, definitely a TV worth demoing and worth taking a look at.
We went into some detail in the last podcast, if people want to listen to it. It is up there on AV Forums, where we went into the issues with the 50 Hz, which was an issue from last year's TVs. It's still there on the models, but certainly on the VT30, I was surprised at how subtle it is this year. It certainly took a while for me to pick up on it still being there, and that was watching football material where, you know, in the past it's been really, really easy to see that feature. So I guess there are a couple of little things that do happen. The floating blacks have gone to be replaced by
something else.
But again, it's subtle. It's one of these things that I think is going to come down to personal preference, personal taste, and whether people see it or not. And I know there's some guys on the forums that take their TVs very seriously. And to be honest, guys, I think you're going to be disappointed with every TV that comes out this year, because there are no pioneer beaters out there, because nobody's going to build a TV like that these days.
No, I mean, Pioneer tried to, and look what happened to them. What's interesting about your review is you were in the unique position of being able to directly compare the VT20 from last year with the VT30 this year and the Pioneer. So from the point of view of black levels, you had a direct comparison. And also from the point of view of 50 Hz material, you could compare all three displays simultaneously.
Yeah.
So you know, and you're obviously a very experienced videophile. So if you're saying that it wasn't much of an issue this year on the VT30, then I think that's great news all around. And certainly, if you're confirming that the black levels were Kuro-esque, to use that phrase, fantastic. So at least there's a TV out there that you can buy in stores as opposed to on eBay that's offering performance levels on a par with the pioneers of old.
Well, thank you for the very nice comment there, checks in the post. I had all three sitting next to each other. I think we've been very fortunate in the fact that we've had the three TVs to compare against each other. And, you know, there was a lot of talk about the figures that were measured. I knew that was going to happen. That's why there's a huge paragraph above that explains that these basic measurements, they're not repeatable, they're not measurable, they're not worth the paper that they're written on. But people wanted to have that detail in there. But the real test is how it actually looks. You know, the meter can tell you all sorts of different things, but, you know, I'll give my next month's wage to anybody that can sit down and tell me 0.01 against 0.02.
Yeah, and I totally agree with you. The only measurement I think that does bear some scrutiny is anti-contrast ratios, which are very impressive on the Panasonics.
Yeah, but again, it's one of these things that type of measurement is only going to be valid for comparison between reviews that you do, Steve.
True.
You know,
what I was saying specifically was the fact that when you measured black on a black screen against black on checkerboard, the black was measuring almost identically the same, which is quite good when you consider there are white panel, white squares around that black. That's an impressive performance, I thought. But otherwise, I totally agree with you, Phil. The numbers are totally spurious. You know, it depends on the environment you're testing in, what equipment you're using. You know, and you're right, I can't tell between 0.01 and 0.02, and nobody else can either.
I mean, just looking at that checkerboard, you can usually tell what the dynamic range and contrast of a panel is going to be like, and that's one of the things that really stood out with the old Kuros was the fact, you put a checkerboard up there, you could see the dynamic range of that set there and then. You could see how well and how wide that was, and you know, then adding in some stair steps and all the rest of it, you could get a general good feel for, just the power under the bonnet in terms of, you know, how that panel's going to work. And the VT30 is very much like that. You know, it has that deep black, great white. It's not the brightest TV out there. It is a plasma. But in terms of actually watching film content, shadow detail, gradation, it's really, really up there with some of the best TVs that we've seen in years gone by. Is it a Kuro beater? Well, to be honest, things have moved on since Kuro. We're now, you know, in the 3D age, which we've been talking about. And, you know, these TVs have to offer more than what a Pioneer did 2 or 3 years ago. You know, it has to have more bells and whistles on there to compete in the market. And whether we like it or not, the enthusiast market in the UK is tiny compared to the mass market. And I guess we're coming back to some points that we made earlier in the podcast when we were talking about, you know, passive against active 3D and that kind of thing. You know, the public don't necessarily look at image quality. And, you know, as an ex-police officer who used to go into people's houses on a regular basis, that holds very true, because some of the atrocious images that people would put up with on the TV was pretty astounding. So when you see that and you see the mass market, you understand pretty quickly that, you know, in terms of a quality display, if you want a professional display that's going to do things, you're going to have to go and buy a professional display. A consumer TV can only do so much. And in those terms, you know, a consumer TV is going to have its flaws. The VT30 has its flaws. Go out and see one. See if it's going to bother you. If it's going to bother you, then you're going to be kind of stuck this year, because, you know, most TVs this year, from what we've seen at the trade shows and so on, Steve, I think the VT30 stands out there, where I'm struggling to recommend another TV at the moment at that performance range.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you, Phil. Of all the TVs that we've seen so far this year, and that's pretty much most of them, by far and away, the one that stood out the most was the VT30 in terms of its image quality and performance. You know, a lot of the manufacturers are pushing LED backlighting, ultra-thin displays. And from my experience, they have really big issues with uniformity, backlight uniformity. So that's one problem. You know, the reality is, and you've mentioned it, Phil, is that the VT30, for example, you know, people on the forums who are enthusiasts will pick it up on tiny little things that the average viewer is not going to notice. 99% of people will not spot the 50 hertz bug or anything else for that matter. But what they will notice is that they get two pairs of active shutter glasses. It does 3D. It's THX certified. It has streaming, networking. It's got the new Viera Connect platform, quite a snazzy remote control. You know, there's lots and lots of things about that TV that are amazing. And unfortunately, I think sometimes the enthusiast has a tendency to become obsessed with tiny little things that perhaps in the great scheme of things aren't that important.
And that's not us having a go, because we are exactly like that.
No, we're just as bad, yeah.
we're just as bad. And I know Russell's just as bad when it comes to speakers. And
actually,
his
a shocker.
the point I'm making is the manufacturers aren't making the TVs for the, you know, for the minority. They're making it for the mass market.
And that was pointed out to me in quite specific terms by Panasonic. I asked them, I said, will you build... an enthusiast TV. All the panels are made in the same place. You're just changing the electronics. Put some, you know, really good video processing in there. Don't spend $20 on the chip. Spend $120 on the chip. You know, give us a $6,000-$7,000 TV, but give us a $6,000-$7,000 TV that is the absolute best thing that's, you know, ever happened to the TV industry. And the answer was, you're having a laugh. It ain't going to happen.
Well, they do that. You can buy the VX200, but it's going to cost you 48,000 quid.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there you go. That's for another market. That's with big markups. They're going to make their money on building, you know, 5 to 10 of those a year for each market sector. Yeah. But when you're talking about an enthusiast TV, they just can't do it. And I mean, look at Pioneer. I mean, Pioneer tried really hard. And Pioneer weren't charging that much different money 3 years ago to what's being charged now for the 50-inch VT. You know, there wasn't a great deal of difference in there. I think a 50-inch Pioneer would set you back 2.8 to 3. The VT's, what, 2.3 to 2.5?
Yeah.
So not a great deal of difference in price. But the fact was that Pioneer had no scale when it came to...
No economies of scale, no,
yeah,
in terms
exactly.
of production. And I think it's worth remembering another thing, too. Though the Kuro was an amazing TV, it wasn't perfect. I mean, Kuro, you can hear a buzzing noise if you put your head close to it. So. Yeah. In fact, you hear a buzzing noise when the volume's low. So, you know, no TV is perfect, unfortunately.
Yeah.
There's always going to be issues. It's a question of whether that issue is something that you can live with or not.
Yeah, and I think if we're going to see a TV that is going to work for the enthusiasts, the vast majority of enthusiasts are not going to be able to afford it. And I'm thinking back to things like the VX100, Steve, the 65 inch and the 50 inch. I mean, you're talking about $5,000 to $8,000 TV there. And, you know, they put all the best technology they had in there. It was a fantastic TV, one of the best pictures I'd seen for a long time. But the thing was, it didn't have the black levels of the Pioneer. And when dealers were trying to sell these TVs next to the Pioneer, the Pioneer was flying off the shelf because it had the black levels. Whereas the, you know, the VX100 was a solid image, and in some respects a better image than the Kuro in terms of PWM noise, in terms of colour and colour gradation and so on. It was a far better performer because it was built for the professional market. So maybe there might be some hope there with the VX200 line if they bring in
a more realistically priced display.
Well, if they bring in the smaller screen sizes, because the VX starts at something like an 85 inch.
Yeah, so, 85 inches, yeah.
I don't have room for an 85 incher. Do you, Russell?
Not yet.
Neither do I, although I will be making room.
Anyway, you can hang a projector. If you can bolt a projector screen to your wall, you can fit an 85 inch on the wall. Mind you, it's a slightly different price proposition.
I'm not kidding. They had to use a forklift truck to move that TV when I went to review it. but hopefully by the end of the month I will be getting a 65 inch VT30 in for review, so it'll be interesting to see how that stands up on a much larger screen than the 50 inch that you reviewed.
Yeah, and I just forgot there is a rumour, I won't say where the rumours come from, but quite a reliable source, VX300 possibly Q4 of this year. So it'd be interesting to see just what they've got up their sleeve there.
Because the point I made in the VX200 review is that although these are extremely expensive displays, they are the cutting edge of technology. So what we'll see on a potential VX300 is basically what we're going to be seeing in 2012's line.
We have IFA coming up as well in September. And although I don't know exactly what the announcement is, I have been told that there is an announcement coming IFA for Panasonic. So we'll wait and see what that is as well. Don't have any more details.
I know what it won't be. It won't be announcing passive TVs.
Well, I think that's pretty safe. Okay, we're going to take another quick short break, and we'll be back in a few seconds.
You're listening to the AV Forums podcast.
Right, welcome back. And to finish off our home cinema podcast this month, is what is home cinema? Guys, tell me, what's home cinema?
Russell?
It's whatever you want it to be. That's not very helpful, is it? I don't know. We were discussing this earlier, weren't we, prior to the podcast? I mean, is it bolting an 80-inch plus projector screen and dimming the lights and throwing the popcorn on and recreating the cinema in your front room? Or is it just simply a good sound system and TV that makes the best of the picture or whatever you've got available? I don't think you can draw a particularly clear line as to what is simply AV and what is home cinema. I think it's a rather fuzzy grey area, and well, I suppose in forum land you'll certainly get people who'll draw a line in the sand and say it's this and it's not that, but I'm not so sure myself.
My definition of home cinema would be, as the name suggests, the idea of replicating the cinema experience at home.
Let's not forget, that's not a very good thing sometimes.
I think that's kind of the goal of that. That's the nirvana, if you like. That's what you're hoping to achieve ultimately. Is, and I've been an enthusiast in home cinema for 20 or more years, you know, and I think my ultimate goal has always been that dedicated home theater, you know, proper big home cinema, big screen, you know, 7.1 sound projector, blacked out walls, you know, basically. The idea of recreating cinema experience at home is the goal that I've wanted to achieve. But as you've just mentioned, Russell, for most people, or a lot of people, that's not necessarily realistic. You know, if you're using, if you've only got one room, for example, a lounge, you can't black that out and have a big screen and, you know, or necessarily. I mean, you can, but it's not always going to be practical. And certainly, I think a lot of girlfriends and wives aren't too happy when you start putting projector screens on the wall and speakers all over the place and cables everywhere. So, you know, I think ultimately what home cinema is whatever it is that you can achieve at home. And if that's a 65-inch VT30 and a 5.1 sound system, fantastic. If it's a 42-inch GT30 and a soundbar, because that's all you can afford or all you can fit in your viewing space, then that's great too. I think ultimately is what you make it.
Now, the reason I brought up this subject is that if you look at trade bodies in this industry, they would class a TV with some speakers and 5.1 sound as a media room. And they would only class it as a home cinema if it had a full projection system and a full sound system. So are they right?
If you're looking for definitions, yes. That for me is a definition of a home cinema.
Or is that a home theatre?
Well, yeah, that's the term I always use. Isn't that just an Americanism?
They call, you know, theatre in the UK is the West End of London. You know, that's theatre land. It's, you know, stage plays and musicals. But the Americans refer to the cinema as theatre, whereas obviously in the UK we do it correctly.
But certainly the definition of a media room as being a TV-based system makes sense to me. I mean, I know that's what they do call it. I tend to agree. But obviously, as I just said, a lot of people can't build a home, you know, haven't got the space or the money or, you know, the room to turn a room into a genuine dedicated home cinema. Ultimately, you know, if all they can do is a TV and a 5.1 system, then that's their home cinema.
Well, if I was to get involved in this and give an opinion, I mean, for me, it's always about an experience. Film is an experience. Film is not reality. Movies are not reality. Whether they're based on a true story or something like that, when you watch a movie, it's not reality. It's whether it's a gritty drama or anything, you're not watching reality. You're watching, some people would say, a piece of art. Some people would say it's
a bit of fantasy. It,
yeah, basically. And it's an experience, and you want to experience it as it was intended. Certainly I do. That's been my whole philosophy. I've wanted to recreate that feeling of an event, of a movie, and watching it the way it's supposed to be seen, hearing it the way it's supposed to be heard. That would be my definition of home cinema. Whether that's achieved by watching a film on a TV with, you know, £100 satellite speakers and a Blu-ray player, or whether that's £100,000 worth of high-tech projector and THX everything and noise floor that's under NC15. And I think sometimes, this is a point I wanted to get to, is sometimes we as enthusiasts have more interest in the equipment than what we're actually watching. Would that be a fair point?
That's a very fair point. I mean, I'm an absolute film nut. I've been a film nut since I was a little kid. And I suppose my interest in film and my interest in home cinema have gone hand in hand, because like you, you know, I've wanted to experience the film the way the creator intended. And ideally, that to me, that means on a big screen with a, all-encompassing surround system. But having said that, I've got fond memories of watching films as a child on a little 14-inch black and white TV. And absolutely loving it, because the film, you know, it was the film itself that was important to me. And sometimes you're right. Sometimes we can get so wrapped up in the technology that we forget that what's important really is the film itself. And a great film is a great film no matter where you watch it. And it'll transcend whatever medium you happen to be watching it on, whether it be, you know, on a TV or a projector or a Blu-ray or a DVD or even a VHS tape. A great film is always going to be a great film.
It's easy to forget as well, a lot of those great films from earlier in your life, when you went and saw them and they became the landmarks that they were, your Star Wars, the Jaws, your Aliens, whatever they were, most of them at the time weren't surround sound.
Jaws was mono, of course.
You know, but you'd watch Star Wars in your front room state, wasn't it? You know, it wasn't.
I saw Star Wars in a mono theatre in 77, definitely. Yeah. Also, what's interesting is that as technology evolves, I mean, people now, for a few couple of £1,000, with a Blu-ray, 1080p Blu-ray, a Blu-ray player, 1080p display, and a 5.1 sound system can have better sound and image than someone who was spending £100,000 10 years ago. So, you know, I think technology becomes, you know, sort of the great emancipator liberator, because it brings great quality to everybody rather than to a select few who can afford it.
I'm going to name drop here. Oliver Stone recently, when we saw him recently, and he made a point which kind of stuck with me a little bit. And it was at CES where we were surrounded by technology. And what he said rung really quite true with the way technology is going, just to move that point on that you're making, Steve. And that is that today's kids, they want to watch a movie on their mobile phone. They want to watch a movie on their iPad. They want to watch TV clips on YouTube, and they want to watch on Vimeo, and they've got an attention span of 5 minutes, and then they want something else. And are things moving in that direction? Does it scare you that things are moving in that direction? And what impact does that have? Because technology these days, and Russell, we just have to look at music. We've gone from CD to 128 MP3.
Yeah, not all steps forward are qualitative, are they? I mean, we're talking about some of the changes you're talking about here are more quantitative steps to fill the new space that's been created.
Yeah, I
don't think a lot of it's necessarily been beneficial to the music in itself. I mean, I'm an old timer. I'm only just about to turn bloody 40. But I mean, you know, for me, once upon a time, putting music on was to put the black disc on top of your turntable and listen to an entire side of music in the way that it was structured by the artist in the order that they put it. And these days now you can just cherry pick what you want. I don't think that's necessarily been a step forward. But the fact that it's easier to get hold of than it ever was, I don't necessarily know that that's bad. And don't forget as well, I mean, everybody goes, 128 kilobits, yeah, it's not hi-fi, but it's still better than what you used to be able to listen to on your 30 quid Sony Walkman when you were walking down the street.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, that is true, but quite interesting what you said there, that when you listen to an LP, it was structured the way the artist wanted it. And now, you know, we nitpick what we listen to. We listen to one track of one album and then another track of it. Are we moving to a state of affairs when it comes to film and technology that we could do the same with film? And
I don't know if you could do that with something that's 2 hours long. No.
And also, apart from that, I mean, film's narrative too, so you can't just watch one track, you know, one chapter of a movie. It wouldn't make a lot of sense unless it was, you know, an anthology or something. But I think one of the points Oliver Stone also made, which was another valid point, was moving on from the point about his kids watching stuff on their iPhones. He said, you know, that the Blu-ray probably is as good as it's ever going to get. You know, when we move on as a physical medium, it's the last storage medium that's going to be physical. After this, it'll be downloads. And as we've seen with music, you know, fast, cheap, easy accessible downloads have become more important than high quality sound. Which is why, you know, nobody bought SACD or HD or DVD audio. You know, it's all been just downloads at lower bit rates or high bit rates. The same.
There's an expanded market now for high bit rate downloads.
Well, that's true. There is now.
Yeah. The first thing I do is I buy my CD. The first thing I do is come home and bang it onto the network so I can play it over my squeeze box. Doesn't necessarily mean I've taken a hit in quality because I'm still playing it through the same DAC.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. But then look at iTunes. And how many people use iTunes, and the fact that you're lucky if you can get something at 320 on iTunes.
Yeah, well, yeah, very true. I know they did start doing, I mean, I don't download an awful lot of stuff off iTunes, perhaps because I'm a bit of an old fuddy-duddy. If I want to pay for music, I'd like to know that I've got it as a physical backup somewhere. Perhaps I've had too many computers eat themselves in front of me to risk that again. But, I mean, again, even they've got higher bitrate downloads on some of the music on there now.
But it's an interesting point that you made, Steve, and, you know, trying to encapsulate this still in the conversation of, you know, home cinema, home theatre, is the point that you made there about Oliver Stone when he said that, you know, Blu-ray would be the last physical format. Now, if we think about the next logical step up from Blu-ray in terms of quality, you're then talking about 4K, 2K. 4K, 2K has, I think it's 5 or 6 times the data capacity needed for that format. So it wouldn't fit on Blu-ray anyway, because Blu-ray is not big enough. So making the next logical step up, that can't possibly be download either, because you think of the data that has to be transferred. So are we likely to then fall into the trap that the majority, the mass market, has fallen into with the likes of iTunes and other download services and the likes of Love Film and that type of thing, whereas we're going to download films that are actually poorer quality in the home. Yeah, because that's the way technology is going.
That's the point I was trying to get to, but I think we digressed slightly, which is Oliver Stone's right. I think in the same way that we've gone for simplicity and convenience over quality with music, people and kids particularly, the next generation, if you like, who've grown up in a different way to us, don't care about quality. They're not interested. Like you said, most people don't care about picture quality. Even the people of our generation didn't. They're going to go for the convenience and the ease and the cheapest and easiest option. And I don't think we're ever going to see 4K, 2K as a mass market medium. Honestly, don't. I don't think they're going to develop another disc format that's big enough to handle 4K, 2K. And I don't think people are going to buy it because people are going to say, well, I'm happy with 1080p. I think we're at the end as far as image quality goes. I mean, to be honest, as you've already pointed out, the cinema's effectively 1080p. I know you can get more resolution than that from a 35mm piece of film, but that's not being used much anymore either. I mean, the last two Star Wars movies were shot with 1080p, and most digital movies are shot on 1080p using a Red One camera, although they can shoot at a higher resolution if they want to. But they don't, because ultimately I don't think that's going to happen. I think that we are reaching the end of things of high quality images in the same way as we've already passed high quality audio is gone. And Oliver Stone's right in that respect. These are the dying days, and we should make the most of it while we can.
So I guess the point we're coming to is we try to define what home cinema was. We have our ideas of what home cinema is. I'm sure our listeners have an idea of what home cinema is, but as technology moves on, as we get more of these new technology products like the iPad and so on coming in, and we get to the next generation, what kind of future does that have, and are we going to move to, I guess some of us already have, but are we going to move to a house that's networked and we choose what we want to watch when we want to watch it, and do we sacrifice on quality?
Yeah, I think there's definite tendency towards that, and I think going back to the subject that we started off this whole podcast on, 3D, I mean, that's an example of manufacturers trying to bring something new to the market, and as far as I can tell, amongst the mass market at least, there's a large degree of apathy towards it. I think people don't really care for the obvious reasons. It's additional new disc player, or they've got to buy 3D Blu-rays. They've got to wear glasses. It's just, they're not interested. It's not convenient. It's not cheap. It's not simple.
I still think there's enough people out there who will be willing to pay for the difference in quality. And I don't think if anybody's got the choice of sitting down in front of their 1080p 50-inch display or watching something on an iPad, they're going to make the choice to sit there and watch it on their iPad in the home. I think it's like all these, I've heard it all before. Yeah, oh, we've reached the end of this. CD's the best thing you'll ever hear. No, it's not. And people are paying for things that sound better. I don't know. It'll fragment into sort of more market niches. But I'm not. I can perhaps see the limitations on the need for greater picture quality. But I don't know that people wouldn't pay for it if it's there.
No, I don't disagree with that, Russell, but I think the numbers of people that will pay for it if it's there are quite small, relatively speaking.
Yeah, but that's true of any high-end pastime. That's why it's high-end.
But like you, I still buy CDs because I like to have something physical. But then I immediately rip it onto iTunes, and I can guarantee you that I'll most likely listen to that music on my iPod, even though I have a reasonably nice stereo system at home. It's very rare that I actually sit down, put on a CD and listen to it because, frankly, I haven't got time, and I'm doing other things. It's quite easy to multitask when I'm at my laptop, listen to music on iTunes while I'm writing a review or whatever, because it's convenient, and that goes back to everything. With movie watching, same with TV, actually. TV.
Well, that convenience just means listen to music in places that you probably wouldn't have in the past.
Yeah, but also you tend to multitask.
You have to turn the stereo up very loud to hear it at the bottom of the garden.
True. But also, I think you multitask a bit more too. You tend to do things. When I'm watching TV, it's very rare that I'm just watching the TV. I'll be watching TV and doing something else at the same time. The only exception to that rule are movies. If I go in the home cinema, it's to watch a film, and my phone's off, and there's nothing else in there, and that's the whole point of it. So for me, that's home cinema. It's a refuge.
Well, yeah,
that's much the way I treat my music as well when I get the opportunities.
Yeah. I'm the same. I mean, I've got a dedicated room there that never gets used because I don't have the time anymore. it's one of these sad things, and I guess it's the same for the vast. majority of people now. I think we've got such busy lives, no matter what we do for a living and no matter what we do in terms of whether we've got family, kids and all the rest. I think time's just more valuable these days. And I think this is where, you know, gadgets like an iPad and an iPhone and that kind of thing comes in, where, you know, we'll sit down, we'll have the laptop on our lap, the TV on, and we'll be doing two or three different things at once. And I guess this is the way things are going to move forward. I see it happening myself, because, you know, I very rarely sit down in the cinema because I think, well, it's an hour and a half, I could be doing something else.
Yeah, well, I mean, I tend to make time because I kind of feel that having gone to the effort of building a home cinema, I should at least use it. And also, for me, watching movies is you know, one of my major pastimes. So it's a bit like Russell listening to his music. You know, it's a chance to get away from everything for an hour and a half, which was always what the cinema was about. Even when you were a kid and you went to the cinema, it was that, you know, escape for 2 hours somewhere else in you know, an artificial environment that you were talking about at the beginning of this discussion, Phil. And for me, that's what it is still. You know, even today, I've achieved my goal of creating a cinema at home, and I like to get away and escape to it every now and then and watch something for 2 hours and then come back to the real world and get on whatever I was doing before.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of my goal. It's part of my ultimate goal with the room I've now got in the outbuilding, which I want to turn into a separate home cinema stroke listening room. The thing is, in a way, that's a convenience issue, because, I mean, I've got, you know, the child, you know, boys in bed, the wife goes to bed earlier than I do. I've then got an hour or so in the house at night when I could go and do all of those things, but can't because it's in the same house as them. It's just a matter of convenience putting it out there will make it more convenient for me to go and do it. Now, equally, the iPod has allowed me to do things in a convenience fashion that with time that was wasted otherwise. Sitting in the car on the way home, I can now podcast some comedy or something like that, or even an AV Forums home cinema review. Not that I'd fit it in. Not that I'd fit it into even my 1 hour commute on the way home, but you know, it's brought that convenience and allowed you to do it in other places where previously you would have just been sitting there twiddling your thumbs.
Yeah,
so I think it cuts both ways to a certain degree. I think you've got a much greater diversity of ways of consuming media, and that doesn't necessarily equate to you know, downsampling it all into something of lower quality, just something more convenient for when the time's appropriate.
One of the scary things for me is my nephews and nieces and the way that they consume media. And we're talking various ages here, from about six up to teenagers. And the way they consume media these days, I can't see them sitting down for an hour and a half or 2 hours and watching a film. Everything's watched in little bite-sized bits, and then they lose interest and it's onto something else, and, you know, they're texting on the mobile or doing something on the laptop, and then they'll maybe watch another 10 minutes of a movie. Is that what the next generation's gonna be like?
I'm not entirely convinced it will. Otherwise cinemas would be dying on their feet, and they're not. They're full of kids watching two-hour-long films.
Well, yeah, that's true, Russell, because I think the biggest market for cinema remains teenagers, certainly sort of the 15 to 25 bracket.
Yeah. Look at the 3D releases that you mentioned earlier on coming up this year.
Yeah, true. That's a good example. Transformers 3D being a very good example. But I think that's because going to the cinema is an event, you know, and therefore you're prepared to commit the time and watch something for 2 hours. I suspect that in the home environment, less so. And as Phil's pointed out, the attention span's a lot less, and people tend to be doing multitasking, doing different things, and you're less likely to sit down and just do one thing for an hour and a half.
Well, I think we've come to the end. I think home cinema's safe for at least another 10 years, at least, anyway. But in interesting conversation.
I hope so, Phil. Otherwise, we're both out of a job.
Yeah, interesting conversation, and we want to get the listeners' views on this, so why not give us your thoughts under this podcast in the forum? Just write us a quick post. What are your thoughts on, you know, where things are going in the future, the technology that's now available, technology that's likely to come along? Will we see 4K, 2K, or is that just a pipe dream for us enthusiasts? And, you know, are the next generation not going to be interested in film? Who knows? Give us your opinions. And I think that's enough time tonight, guys. We seem to have gone on quite a bit there, but lots of interesting stuff coming along on AV Forums. For the latest reviews, go to avforums.com/reviews. There are reviews coming up there from Steve. You should have that LG, and we're also looking at a Samsung plasma in the next few weeks.
That's right, yep.
And from Russell, we're going to have that Toyful review and hopefully SVS subwoofer.
And indeed, if I can put it in some Tannoy-M wall loudspeakers that are finally installed in my home.
Excellent. So lots to look forward to. We'll be back next month with the next Home Cinema podcast. This is Phil Hinton saying thanks for listening, and we'll see you again soon.
The AV Podcast was presented by Phil Hinton. Original music by Andrew Bassett and Richard Cosgrove. The AV Podcast was mixed and produced by Phil Hinton, and the senior producer was Stuart Wright. All content, including sound clips and music, is copyright material and featured for promotional use only. The AV Podcast is copyright M2M Limited.